first time.
Now, Dr. Joan Kenley, psychologist and author of Whose Body Is It Anyway, brings you Conversation Radio.
Hello, I'm Joan Kenley, welcoming you to The Joan Kenley Show, bringing you Conversation Radio, a program where talking really matters. Today we're talking about Valentine love. There's some quotes that speak to this yummy subject. Have you heard, for instance, that love is the greatest refreshment in life? Or where there's love, there's life. And at the touch of love, everyone becomes a poet. Well, you'll probably be reading these phrases if you're in the market for Valentine cards this year. And I want you to take a moment, however, to honor Esther Howland, the woman who produced the first commercial American Valentines back in the 1840s. Her idea struck gold, and she sold a mind-boggling $5,000 in cards during her first year of business. Today, over 1 billion Valentines are sold and sent in this country every year, second in number only to Christmas cards. And as you might guess, around 85% of all Valentines are purchased by women. But in addition to cards, there are millions of boxes of chocolates and bouquets of roses purchased, mostly by men, for February 14th, which is on the calendar in Canada, Mexico, the United Kingdom, France, and Australia. We're going to celebrate love with a capital L right here today as we delve into this most universally fascinating subject. And we're lucky to be joined in the studio by two wonderfully qualified guests, Dr. Brenda Wade and Ed McClune. And Brenda's been with us before on our Intention and Soul Purpose shows, and you can find them archived on our website, joankenley.com. Dr. Wade is a San Francisco-based psychologist, author, television host, and producer. National audiences know Brenda from her syndicated TV program, Can This Marriage Be Saved?, her PBS shows, and her recent guest appearance on The Today Show. She's also a regular host on the Bay Area TV show Black Renaissance. Her newest book is Power Choices, Signposts on Your Journey to Wholeness, Love, Joy, and Peace. And Ed McClune is a licensed marriage and family therapist specializing in couples counseling. He also works as a supervising process teacher for the Hoffman Institute, teaching relationship intensives throughout the country. Formerly a host for KBLX, The Quiet Storm, Ed now maintains a private therapy practice in Marin and Sonoma, California, where he currently lives with his family. I'd like to start the conversation by asking you both, just what are the ingredients that help people fall in love?
I would say the most important thing still is that simple physical attraction. I still think that's the thing that
it's first, the chemistry.
It captures because you see the person or you hear the voice, and these days maybe you read the email. Can you have a sexy email? I guess so.
I think so.
Let's see. What are the statistics? I think it's 38% of people who meet and marry today meet and marry in some internet-related way.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah. Most people still meet and marry through friends and family. That's the highest, right?
That's the highest. And it doesn't, you know, the method of meeting isn't so much the deal as when they do, what happens and why.
Of course.
All the different people in a party or a social event, why is she really attractive? Right. Why does he really?
Is it the pheromones that they talk about? Or what is that chemistry that really attracts people? That, of course, is something they'd like to put in a bottle, you know.
Right. Well, you know what's funny is I was just thinking as we started talking about the internet, it used to be across a crowded room, you know, you'd see the stranger. But a lot of people that I'm working with now say to me, when I got that email and it made me laugh, or I got the email and I could tell from what he or she said in the email that they had that certain something that attracted me. So in a funny way, I was just thinking maybe we're getting more focused on the inner being right off the bat by using the internet rather than looking at that exterior, which can be oh so misleading.
It can be oh so misleading, and that's where the infatuation stage comes in, because couples are so taken by what they see or hear or imagine that person does or who they are in the world that that person takes on a persona that doesn't even belong to them.
Yeah.
And the falling in love happens both ways like that.
Right.
People fall in love often with the image in
exactly.
the first place, and you have to sort of work through that because that's a very heady high, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. Go ahead, Ed, because I think I know what you're going to say. Go ahead.
See, isn't that love? I think I know what you're going to say. Sometimes I tell couples, you know, the path of committed love is full of serial disillusionment.
Oh, okay.
You know, that different points in time, like puppy love, the infatuation
sure.
stage, has to get broken. The balloon bubble has to burst.
It does. And sometimes one person has more projection on the other one, you know, and then it's tilted. Someone gets on a pedestal
that.
And
yeah.
the other one is sort of in reality and they don't understand why this
right.
person thinks they're Helen of Troy or
well,
Troy.
Joan, you said the operative word. That's where I was headed, is that initially, I really think when people meet and fall in love, there is a lot of projection. And that sounds negative, but it really isn't. I firmly believe that we look for the person who can help us to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And that the healthiest relationships are sometimes the ones where, well, I think usually the ones where we have the most growth going on. And that can be messy. It can be disillusioning. It can be all sorts of things. But ultimately, when we get past all the projecting, now when I say projecting, I mean there's, what's the guy's name? Terry Gorski. Who did a lot of 12-step work. Terry used to say, there's the boing mm-hmm. effect. You meet the person and you get boing. He said, if you get that, you should run.
Right.
Because that means you have just run up against your projections.
Mm-hmm.
That something about that person reminds you of
oh, I've heard
mom,
this from so
dad,
many clients.
You name
yes.
it. Yeah.
yeah.
And then if you get the boing and you don't run, you are going to be in there spending who knows how much time clearing up your own issues, your own projection. Now, I don't think that's bad.
No, but I also think that there is something yummy if people are really falling in love that gives people an endorphin high and a sense of flowers
yes.
and candles and romance that really is not going to last. Because they just know this in,
yes.
in the literature and in real life. And so to prolong that in a conscious way is kind of a nice thing. And then I know couples 5 and 10 years later are recreating dates and moments so that it brings back the memories
right.
of that moment.
Which
of
is important
love.
Because it keeps you going when you're in there doing all the hard work.
Yeah, the lovey-dovey stuff.
Which yes. you have to do.
You have to do
the hard work.
So that boing, I think, has an element of being essential.
Yeah.
It's what draws us together. I think for
sure.
men, maybe in particular, it's
sure.
sort of like, well, okay, I'll give up Sunday football for that.
yeah, right.
And it's sort of, well, how do we...
Do you spell that S-E-X? As opposed
now
to
we're getting
T-H-A-T.
Into the nitty-gritty. Good, Brenda.
You got me blushing.
Sorry,
it's the radio.
Yeah. It's a nice
the audience
shade of
can
rose.
Tell us we're having a good time here.
That's right. So, you know, from Hoffman process teachers, some of the orientation we see is a lot of that attraction is mom and dad. And
yes,
certainly
yes.
the Hendrixes and a lot of different people have written books about imago and things as, you know, that initial attraction. Part of that Boyne factor is who raised me.
Right.
And
yes.
how does, I mean, many of the listeners could probably answer the question, well, who were you attracted to in that intimate relationship? Some version of mom or
well,
dad?
Well, it can be, but it's interesting. In the Diamond Heart work that I was in for so many years, the teaching was that possibly a positive mother double transference, now we're really getting into words here, is where both people like the mom part of each other. For instance, I do feel that my husband and I have a good mom exchange here between us for our lasting relationship. And I don't know the reasoning behind all of that, but there is a nurturing quality to the mother affect that probably makes someone feel supported, taken care of,
yeah.
nurtured in the long run.
Now, the flip side of that are people who don't have nurturing moms.
Well, yes, of course.
Who end up attracted to one another because they're trying to work that out.
Right.
And my first book, Love Lessons, one of the first things I talk about is that partners are mirrors.
Mm.
And whatever it is in me that I'm trying to work through is going to show up in my partner and really irritate me a lot
mm-hmm.
until I clear up my stuff.
Sure.
You know, that old adage, whatever bugs me about the other person exists in me. And
I totally believe in that. When you're, yeah. you know, mad at somebody, what are you mad at in yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Is always a good question.
Yes, exactly.
Do you find that so, Ed?
Absolutely. And part of the work we do is actually have a couple make a list of the 10 things about your partner that really bother you.
Mm-hmm.
And so, okay, now look down that list. How is that an element of your life, or at least maybe an element of mom and dad's life?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or a reactive formation in me that I would, you know, I try to do the opposite at all times.
Explain what reactive formation is to the audience.
Well, a simple thing would be something, let's say that someone in your life will say, mom. Say mom was really, whatever, condescending or weak,
critical.
Submissive. I was going the other way.
Let's
say submissive mom
okay.
or something.
Passive.
And I saw that and how she got taken advantage of. So I'll never let anybody walk over me. So maybe I'll go through life armored. So no mm-hmm. one's going to, mm-hmm. I'm going to be anybody's pushover. So that's an example.
That's the reaction formation, which are, you know, good words for us to know about. But what I would like to say is that hormones get into all of this too, as part of the attraction. And we know so much more about what those hormones are. It's part of love being magical. You know, when they first fall in love, couples feel like they have a perfect romance, that it's going to last and last, and everything becomes technicolor and energized and creative and euphoric and almost invincible. And then there's a cocoon around them that radiates between them and to others, and it makes others wish for the same elixir. During those weeks or months of magic, a treasure chest of memories can be harvested for the times ahead when real life becomes real life again. And so where there's room for disappointment to walk in, frustration, sorrow, and new learning, we know we have a really good relationship. And there are days when deeper love can come calling and when a new definition of intimacy and caring can emerge as they go to the step we're going to talk about next, the reality phase. But there's a fair amount of talk in the news today about oxytocin, the bonding chemical that is released when we make love. The amount released increases the quality and quantity of the encounters. In other words, more orgasms equal more oxytocin, which in turn enhances more feelings of closeness. But not just orgasms are part of this picture. Physical affection, deep conversation, feeling seen and heard and appreciated go a very long way toward a healthy relationship.
You found it, and it's different. The Joan Kenley Show.
Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever. When you hold me tight, fever. In the morning, a fever all through the night.
What's not to love about the Joan Kenley Show, where talking truly matters.
Hello, I'm Joan Kenley, and you're back with the Joan Kenley Show, where we're focusing today on Valentine love. We're joined by psychologist and author Brenda Wade and Ed McClune, a marriage and family therapist who specializes in couples counseling. The origins of Valentine's Day are shrouded in mystery. In the Middle Ages, Europeans began to send love letters on Valentine's Day because people believed that birds began to mate on February 14th. That's an interesting way of looking at it. But today, the Catholic Church recognizes at least three different saints named Valentine, all of whom were martyred on February 14th. However, none of us are saints, so when we're faced with the reality phase in our partnerships, what kind of understanding is needed? So let's dive into that, why not, and say, when the bloom comes off the rose of that oxytocin glow that we talked about in the first stage of romance, what things can creep in on tiptoe that we have to pay attention to and that might not be awful, but they are real?
I was just thinking about when that happened for me. I remember it didn't tiptoe in my experience.
It didn't.
It was like cold water being thrown on me. I was going along going, God, he's the most brilliant guy I've ever met. And we can talk about anything. And then I said something and he went, well, that's not true. And
bingo.
I was like, hello, actually this is true. And then I found out the hard way that I had inadvertently put my finger on a hot button. Something that was going on for my sweetie at that point, only I didn't know
of course
that it
not.
Was going on. And that was
we
my
can't
rude
read minds yet. Yes.
But I think that happens for a lot of couples.
It does.
I don't think that's
it
a unique
does.
Experience. You're going along just thinking, finally, I found the one. And mm-hmm. and the one is just more perfect than I ever imagined they would or could be.
True.
Until that moment when we hit some piece of business, as I like to call it, that's unfinished.
Yeah.
And then the bubble bursts.
And the bubble bursts big time. Mm-hmm. Big time. And we're down in there going, well, now, wait a minute.
And then an awful lot of times, you know, it's sort of classic is one member of the couple will retreat, and the other, sensing the retreat, will advance. Oh, wait a minute. I didn't mean that. Please don't, you know.
Yeah.
And which only irritates the retreater more.
Of course. Of course.
Yeah.
And of course, sometimes when we get that cold dash, we want to pretend that it didn't come. I had that experience early in my life when I thought I wanted to be engaged to somebody, and I moved from New York City to Washington, D.C. to be with him. And I had never really lived in his neighborhood, and I moved into an apartment near his house, and it was very different from any place I had been before. And when he came over to pick me up to do something the day after we moved, he came to the door and wanted to know if I wanted to go dirt bike riding with he and his 10-year-old son. And in that moment, I knew I would never marry him. Because, I mean, I'm really not a dirt bike rider. And something about the way he showed up at the door, as if the romance was in part was over. He was dressed in, you know, sort of really casual clothes. But it wasn't the clothes and it wasn't anything else but the fact that dirt bike riding was not on my radar. But I wanted to mend that inside after that first experience of feeling, uh-oh, and I stayed in that for another year.
Did you go dirt bike riding? I have to know.
I went and watched dirt bike riding.
There you go.
As a compromise and as a way of saying, I can try to embrace this. And I tried so many ways to feel or maybe pretend that this was going to be the relationship. And of course, that doesn't work, does it?
No, pretending doesn't work.
No.
You got that right, Jen.
No.
God.
Well, discernment is a great thing, what you were just talking about. You know, what's commitment mm-hmm. and what's martyrdom?
There you go.
Yeah. Fine line, yeah. Which is which. And you know, there is a way to tell, in case anybody's wondering. Commitment feels really energizing. You feel good, you feel alive, and martyrdom always makes some part of your body hurt.
And of course, you have to look at different personality types as we look at how we react and what we do. And in one personality typology, my profile is to be the martyr and to be the person who gives over and tries to be everything to everyone
right.
else.
And if you fall too far into that, you without a doubt will start to feel angry, resentful.
Sure.
And in my case, it was always my stomach that would clench up.
Okay.
And I learned to read that sign. If my stomach's clenching, I have crossed the line.
Mm-hmm.
Got to get myself back on the other side of the line and stay there.
Sure. And what do guys find as something that brings them down to reality in your practice, Ed? What do you see breaking that balloon?
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked about a gender-specific question, because I think men and women do enter and deal with relationships, and not to demean men too much, but I think we really do need to be trained.
I'm not going to disagree with you.
We'll let him have that one, won't we, Jim?
Oh, finally, I'm on your side.
Go on, Ed.
You know, that I know that if I got away with what I would normally do through a casual day in my life, and my wife didn't call to mind, this isn't commitment, this isn't how to treat me, this isn't taking care of me, it's not romantic, I could just easily go about watching sports on television and noodling in the yard
mm-hmm.
and not really answer the call of what a commitment to another human being and in a heterosexual to my wife mm-hmm. In a heterosexual relationship would mean. Mm-hmm. And so part of it is just opening up to the gift that our partner can bring us. And for me as a heterosexual man, the gift that this woman can bring me over and over again, which are a lot of times hard to swallow and usually needed some kind of tussle or, you know, what somebody says is a fight of who gets to define reality in the relationship.
Mm-hmm. That's a great way to say it.
To finally give in and say, you know, after bruising and not, to say, oh, she's got a point there.
Well, doesn't it also come down to the fact that you were describing that you want to do something, you know, watch the game or fiddle in the yard? But basically, women love to talk about what is and what's happening and what's going to happen and what has happened.
And what we're feeling.
Exactly. What we're feeling. Exactly.
And so when I catch on to that and make compromises in, my life actually gets better than watching football.
Sure.
But I have to sort of be broken out of that commitment to the tried and true method to be a learner.
Even though you are a skilled relationship counselor, you still work on yourself.
Oh my God.
All the time, right?
I think all it means
is having failed and having succeeded and been a father and a stepfather, it leads me to think that actually to succeed in relationship for a man or woman, we have to be open to learning and actually curious about the other.
Every single day.
Yeah, I remember when Terrence Real's book first came out. His first book was called I Don't Want to Talk About It.
Oh, okay.
And it was about, just to stay on the gender issue for a minute.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
Talking about men and their, I don't want to talk about my feelings. And his follow-up book, which became a runaway bestseller, by the way, but his follow-up book was How Do I Get Through to You? Reconnecting Men and Women. And I got the manuscript from a friend of mine before it came out. I went, God, this is brilliant. This guy really gets how women feel in relationship. And he said, you know, most men really need to look at the way that men move away from intimacy, and it's something the culture does to men and how men are conditioned. And I gave it to my husband to read. And he said, oh my God. He said, this woman is so hard on men. I said, take a look at the author's name. A man wrote this. Right. And the fact that he is totally busting men. Of course, every woman was going, yay, including myself. But, you know, I do think the culture has a lot to do with men have testosterone.
Sure.
Which, and this is not a put down.
No, it isn't.
I think it moves men in a certain way, and we need that way in relationship, because if women don't have testosterone there, we can become too bound up, I think, in the emotional side and looking within, whereas I find it's very balancing to have the testosterone-driven way of staying in action and moving. And,
sure.
And the outer, it keeps me balanced. And then I hear you saying that you balance by having your wife pull you in the other direction. Now, one thing I want to say, I work with a lot of same-sex couples, and I find that in those relationships between two men or two women, this same dynamic still gets played out.
Oh, of course it does.
It still gets played out, and there's someone always who's pulling one direction, and the other person saying, hey, pay attention, let's stay connected emotionally, let's really work with this, but it's harder. Because, of course, we live in a homophobic society, and it makes it very difficult for same-sex couples to balance this. But it can be done. I want to say that it can be done.
Sure. And also, that goes to, no matter whether it's same-sex or opposite sex, that opposites attract.
Yes.
And one person in the couple relationship handles one part of it beautifully and not the other part, maybe. And so we must look at the birds and bees idea of opposites being an interesting dynamic to make coupledom, doesn't it? So I'd like to mention that Bob Zykowski wrote 10 to-dos for long-lasting relationships, tried and true tips to keep that Valentine love alive all year long. And here they are. Be able to tell each other how you feel. Be intentional about forming a committed us. Learn to deal with conflict. Pay attention to issues of sexuality. Include a spiritual dimension in your relationship. Frequently reinforce your mutual fondness and admiration. Do the little things that are special for one another. Build a firm foundation for compromising. Think and act like a team, and seek out a supportive community. All good ideas you'll find listed on our website. So ponder these tips while I mention that Sean Connery told us that love may not make the world go around, but I must admit, it makes the ride worthwhile. So what's involved and what's sexy about commitment? You won't want to miss this part of our conversation with Ed and Brenda. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
The Joan Kenley Show. Talk radio your way. Dr. Joan Kenley, taking talk radio to the next level.
Hello, I'm Joan Kenley, welcoming you back to the Joan Kenley Show, where we are talking today about Valentine love. Interestingly, it became easier to mail Valentines in the mid-1800s when the modern postal service at that time implemented the penny post. Until then, postage was so pricey that most cards were delivered by hand. I want to point out that we seem to create holidays to remind us of important times in our lives. I was just thinking about that the other night. We have birthdays to remind us how old we are, and we have anniversaries to remind us how long we've been married or at a job. But this got me thinking, why do we celebrate Valentine's Day? Well, one of the most wonderful parts of any relationship is the romantic phase, which some consider to be one of the best parts of falling in love. So it made me wonder whether we have Valentine's Day to remind us of the magic of romance. But many of us know that Valentine passion is the quickest to develop and the quickest to fade. Intimacy develops more slowly and commitment more gradually still. And that's what we're going to talk about now with Dr. Brenda Wade, a San Francisco-based psychologist, author, television host, and producer, and Ed McClune, a licensed marriage and family therapist and a supervising process teacher for the Hoffman Institute in Marin and Sonoma. So as we focus on the commitment phase of a relationship in this segment, should we remember the special feelings conjured up around Valentine's Day and make them part of our everyday relationship, or at least a little more so? Or what else is involved in moving toward commitment? Ed and Brenda, let's just dive in with that.
Well, you know, we were talking in the segment before, I was about curiosity. And for me, that's kind of changing the balloon, the bubble, the fantasy, the projection. And curiosity helps us fill in the reality.
Yes, and curiosity is a sparkly kind of intention, isn't it?
And so being curious about who the other is, and, you know, over the course of a lifetime, I get to learn who my partner is.
Yes.
But also to be actively in that. And, you know, in this theme of romantic love, John Gottman, one of the great researchers in couples, has found some really simple little statistical elements about what makes marriage work. And one of the easiest things to apply, and I tell this to clients all the time, is he found in studying couples over years that in couples and relationships that really work, there's a ratio of about 5 to 1 of kindnesses to trouble.
Oh, that's a good one to know.
And so he calls it sweetening the nest. So that a skill that we can prescribe or ask couples to do is actually intentionally be about the business of being kind to one another.
And that's not a hard assignment.
No, it's very simple. Gee, you look good today.
Exactly.
Yeah. Very important. There's this old Chinese proverb that says, happy marriage means husband and wife treat one another as honored guest.
There you go. I love that.
How would you treat an honored guest? And it seems simple, but one of the things I always look at, because I look at things in terms of energy, the energy, because we can measure energy in words, thoughts, feelings, the energy in being kind is so much higher than the energy in being negative. And if we were to do kinesiology or calibrate the vibratory frequency, it always seems as if anger has more power. But anger actually causes us to lose power. It falls into that realm David Hawkins calls force, whereas love calibrates so much higher on a logarithmic scale. So to get it out of all the physics talk, what it simply means is if you can hold the space for love, and I call it being heart-centered, and just be heart-centered. And this is what I've been working on in my relationship, is just stay heart-centered no matter what's going on. And that always tends to bring about whatever kind of restoration of intimacy or connection that's needed. And I used to go the other direction. I used to think, well, if I get mad enough or upset enough, then I'll be heard better.
Yes, that's a trap that many, many women fall into. And I would have to say that you're describing, with this kindness energy, the Valentine energy that should come in every day, because it is fluffier, it's lighter, and it lasts into the atmosphere energetically in a way that builds instead of tears down.
Exactly. And it's the tearing down of relationship. I know when I was writing my book, Love Lessons, one of the things we looked at three generations of couples. And we found that those couples whose grandparents and parents had a pattern in their relationship of being either critical or angry or some sort of negative, if those couples continued that pattern, whereas the generation before could hold it together because people didn't divorce, the next generation absolutely could not unless they changed the pattern and started practicing kindness. And couples would say, well, but I don't feel that way. And one of the things I sometimes say is fake it till you make it.
Oh, I love that phrase.
You know, just get up in the morning and start being kind. Even if you're feeling pissy, just be kind.
Right. And this is about our home.
Oh, yes.
And if the home is a sweet place to be, then it's a lot safer to have my ugly parts acknowledged and taken responsibility for. I don't have to fight when I'm, sloppy if I know that it's safe because my wife loves me and she's, you know, practice being kind.
Exactly. Yeah. But what I also would like to ask you, Ed, from the man's point of view, is when a man, for instance, wants to be more quiet, and withdrawal is the way that he keeps himself together, and then how does the woman invite the man into more intimacy if his profile is just being quiet and self-absorbed in his work and what he calls his own inner life?
Well, honoring that is a great place to start.
Sure.
And I think that what men don't do well is to actually schedule that cave time or announce it. It just, the partner sort of goes, well, where'd he go?
Right.
You know, if I come home and I'm grumpy because I've had a hard couple of sessions and walk in the door and grumpily walk past, that ambiguity leaves my wife in a bad space.
Sure.
But if I just say, I've had a bad day, it's got nothing to do with you, I'm going to retreat for a while, that's such a gift to her because she doesn't have to worry about what's going on.
Exactly.
But then also to take responsibility to say, and I'll be available at 8 tonight, or I'll be available at some point in time. So it's also saying, I need my time, and I want to be with you too.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was just recently working with a couple where the wife, they have a new baby. The wife was very, very, very upset because she's 24/7 on with the baby, et cetera, et cetera. And her husband, in her opinion, had just left her in the lurch and was absorbed with his job, absorbed with this and that. And she said, I feel like he's just gone. I said, it sounds like he's in his cave, just to use the language. And I said, why don't you just let him be in his cave for a while? And she took a deep breath. She said, oh my God, that's so relieving.
Indeed.
I don't have to go in and get him. I could just let him be in his cave. She said that was a turning point for her to just let him be. And magically, when she stopped going in and haranguing him and telling him how bad and wrong he was for being in there, he came out.
Right. And so commitment in that way is, again, back to kindness, honoring, respecting, and letting, again, the lingo is, have some space for a person to have their own personhood. Because when you have the freedom to have your own personhood, you're freer to come back into relationship, don't you think?
Yeah, and commitment in the relationship, I have my own way of looking at that. I think commitment is a place that we step, we stand. A lot of times people say, well, we fell in love and it's great. I say, yeah, but love doesn't carry itself. We have to carry love. It doesn't carry us. And commitment is where we carry love. We say, all right, I am making a choice. I am going to be in this relationship for whatever reason you choose, because I want to grow, because I love you, because I want companionship. The sex is great, whatever it is. But the commitment is what helps you to carry the love so that you don't go too far off track, either in the cave or too far off track in I've got all these other things going on in my life and I can't pay attention to you. It's kind of the middle ground that we keep coming back to.
And women often say, I can't get a man to commit. I'd like to add to that by saying it's encouraging to know that relationships can hit bad patches and still learn how to recommit to creating and growing together. I've seen many couples who start out by trying to make the best of a rough period in their relationship and in the process found out that it's often more important to love what you've got than it is to get what you think you want. So remember that. Couples trying to resolve their power struggles, disappointments, hurts, and differences, while they need to admit, we don't want to be doing this to each other. We want to be more loving, and we don't seem to know how. Well, this attitude will open the door for the couple to seek counseling or self-help techniques, which can help them enter into a totally different kind of loving, one that is filled with surrender, a deeper level of unconditional acceptance, and a truly more unifying kind of commitment. And we want to acknowledge that the irony of commitment is that it's deeply liberating in work, in play, in love. And what about the mature phase of a relationship? That can happen even in your 20s if that's what's happened for you. But don't miss the rest of our conversation. We'll be right back.
Chances are, 'cause I wear a silly grin the moment.
Ready for more? Dr. Joan Kenley continues in a moment. Log on to joankenley.com, that's K-E-N-L-E-Y, to learn more and listen to archived shows.
Just because my composure sort of slips the moment that your lips meet mine. Chances are you think my heart's your valentine.
Invite your friends and family to listen to The Joan Kenley Show.
Hello, I'm Joan Kenley, and you're back with The Joan Kenley Show, where we're talking today about Valentine love. And that can be for your nephew, your sister, your cousin, your aunt, your uncle. Singles can have self-love for themselves, and we don't want to leave anybody out. Early Valentines were made by hand, as you could imagine, using colored paper, watercolors, and colored inks. And sociologists theorize that printed cards began to take the place of letters, particularly in Great Britain, because they were an easier way for people to express their feelings in a time when direct expression of emotions was not fashionable. Not sure how much that applies today, but with text messaging near at hand, that's a whole other subject. We're joined by Ed McClune today. He's a marriage and family therapist, and he specializes in couples counseling and psychologist and author of two books on relationship, Dr. Brenda Wade. Leo Biscaglia, a media love guru in years past, had these good words to say. Find the person who will love you because of your differences and not in spite of them, and you have found a lover for life. Now, that's describing mature love in my book, and so we're going to continue talking about commitment for a little while before we move into the mature phase. So as we left the last segment, both Ed and Brenda were sort of popping up with some ideas to say about commitment. So let's go there first.
Well, we had the question, what makes it hard for men to commit? And my experience with that is that once a man actually begins to see the value and the benefit of commitment, that for a man who's practical, you know, the hunter, testosterone part of a man, to see that there's actually a book that I quote a lot in my books called The Case for Marriage. I use a lot of their research. It's a very research-intensive book. And they talk about all of the indicators that your life gets better if you're in a committed relationship. And that's up and down the line from advancement at work and mm-hmm. in your career to obviously money, health, on and on. Everything gets better. Mm-hmm. And things you wouldn't expect to get better do get better because I think, first of all, again, looking at things energetically, you've got all this energy collected and focused of two people who are building together a life, and the life works for both people. Both people are making contributions to one another. The old two heads are better than one.
And so then I think that's one and one also can make three, because if you put the spiritual component into the mix, you have an exponential relationship,
right,
that is about being the beloved, which the Levines talk about,
yes,
and about having something that is bigger than both of you as you form your committed relationship.
Right, and I think defining a committed relationship is a big part of the problem here. You know, culturally, it was, for a man, I say I do, and then I go to work. And I have no other accountability to the relationship. Mm-hmm. And obviously, that never worked, and it's certainly not working now. And so hanging in there to actually define, I can only define what a committed relationship is when, whatever, I've bumped up into some obstacle, and I say, whatever this obstacle is, I have a choice here to leave or go get drunk or actually get our way through it.
And then it becomes just the most wonderful feeling, because it's that ship, you're both sailing in the same direction, and there's a container, a virtual container,
yeah,
that is part of what is the bliss of commitment. And it means that I can be seen in all my colors and all my shades and all my faults, and I am still loved. And that's the stepping stone, I think, toward maturity in relationship. And it doesn't mean you have to be 80 years old to be mature in relationship.
Right.
I think young people can be mature if they've gone through these phases. You can be in a mature relationship in your mid-20s.
And some of that is, Joan, you're making me think, some of that is related to how mature you are when you get in the relationship.
Thank you. That's such a good point.
A lot of people have worked on themselves. I find a lot of young people are more sophisticated.
They are.
About the need to talk and communicate than people, say, of my generation, where you kind of came to that after you stumbled and thought, oh, yeah, I better learn to communicate here. But I find that young people, because it's much more in the mass media, people understand, they've watched Friends or watched whatever.
They have an emotional vocabulary.
Yeah, I need to get in there, and I find a lot of young men very well equipped to work problems through, commit, and work through communication difficulties. It's
sure.
amazing.
Sure.
And that old paradigm of commitment is like Stone Age now to a lot of us.
You know,
we
sure
have
it
to
is.
Actually be responsible to the relationship or not. Mm-hmm. And so that's why a lot of us are staying single longer or permanently.
Right.
It's like now it's a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a big choice.
It's not a have to get married in your 20s.
Exactly.
Or find a partner in your 20s. I mean, I didn't find my marriage partner till I was in my 40s. And wow, that was the best thing for me, because I was married to my career in so many other ways for so many years. But we also have to recognize that a lot of things that used to be are no more. And someone in their 70s can find their first real love affair.
Yes.
And so we want to say to people who are single or people who are widows or people who have lost partners, we want to say that romance can come, Valentine's Day can come, in your 80s or 90s, and I have seen it, witnessed it, and loved
yes,
seeing it.
Yes, as have it. I. One of my favorite stories was my friend, Selma, who had been married very young, had kids, and then was widowed quite prematurely and single for about 15 years. So at age 70 or so, or plus, 70 plus, she walked into some gathering, and later, this man that she saw across the room said, the minute she walked in, I knew she was somebody special. And they went on to have a hot, passionate affair until the end of her life. And her granddaughter said, well, Bubby, can I ask you a question? Do you guys do it? And my friend said, every chance we get.
But isn't that just lovely? And
yes.
So in my practice, I would always say to the men or the women who would say, I can't find anybody, you have to, first of all, have the intention that you can.
Yes,
and
strong.
You have to be open to it, because sometimes people don't find others because inside they aren't ready or haven't committed to it in a way that will work. So
or
don't
they
give
have
up.
The negative idea it's not possible.
Yes,
one of the
sure.
places I see that in my second book, When Mama Couldn't Tell Us About Love, I'm writing about African Americans finding love, and there's this statistic that a black woman is less likely to get married than, I've forgotten what it says, than whatever it is, but it's a dire statistic. And I say to women, black women, all the time, if you believe that,
you will make it so.
I
because you will sit around, you'll talk about it, you'll expect it. So all the energy that could magnetize your partnership is going into saying it's not possible.
Exactly.
So I ask people to reverse that and actually write a letter. And this works for anybody, whether you're African American or not. Write a letter that says, this is what I'm looking for. This is how I get to visualizing the intention you spoke of. This is what I would like. Not in he's handsome, he's tall, he's blah, blah, blah.
No,
the qualities I want to experience, and very important, flip that letter over and say, and this is what I'm willing to give, because it's a two-way street.
I did that myself when I decided it was time for me to get married. And believe it or not, it went so quickly after that, it was mind-boggling. But that's a success story that I like to share.
It's usually mind-boggling when we get clear.
Indeed. So, Ed, do you have a final thing you'd like to say in this segment about mature love?
I would say just practice. Finding ways to be about the business of nurturing this most important relationship in our life. Not take it for granted. Find ways to give and be loving.
I love that. So I want to thank you, Ed, and I want to thank you, Brenda.
It's a pleasure, Joe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
So we want to say that we come to love not by finding a perfect person, but by learning to see an imperfect person perfectly. And so I'd like to say thanks so much for listening. We want you to know that the Joan Kenley Show brings you conversation radio that's co-created for your listening pleasure with our guests. You can find out much more about today's subject and how to reach our guests on my website, joankenley.com. That's K-E-N-L-E-Y, where all our shows are archived, downloadable, and podcastable 24/7. We're also on iTunes and the other top 10 podcast directories. Huge thanks go to those who made this show possible, Peter B. Collins and Christy Healy, and here in the studio, Daniel Fletcher, engineer and technical producer. This is Joan Kenley inviting you to keep listening, and we'll keep you in the conversation. Just like a